Welcome to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. This hour, a conversation about art, activism, and the Black Lives Matter movement. Robin Joyce Miller is an artist, poet, educator, and activist for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Her paintings have been exhibited in the Brooklyn Children's Museum, the African American Museum of Hempstead in New York, and her work can be seen locally at the Zion Heritage Museum in Hyannis. Robin spent more than 30 years as a special education teacher and then as an art educator in the New York City schools. She was awarded both the New York City and the New York State Region 8 Art Educator of the Year Award. After retiring to the Cape, she and her husband Jim created a series of Black Lives Matter presentations at the Kituit Center for the Arts, where she also sits on the board. And she sits on the board of other local arts organizations, helping them work to become more diverse, equitable, and inclusive. As you'll hear this hour, Robin Joyce Miller's approach to tackling racism and white privilege is informed by decades of work as an educator, an artist, and her work is also rooted in her faith. And at a time when many of us are grappling with how we can bring about meaningful change in ourselves and our communities, we asked Robin back to the program to talk about what guides and informs her work in diversity, equity, and inclusion. We'll also ask her to share some of her research into Black history on the Cape. Welcome, Robin. We're so glad to have you back.
Good morning, Catherine. Hi, how are you? And good morning to all your listeners.
I'm well, and I'm glad to have you with us this morning. I want to talk a little bit about you at first. You, as I said, you're an artist. You also were an educator in New York. Talk a little bit about your work in both fields and how they kind of merge together.
My story is an interesting one because, first of all, I grew up in a totally Black environment. My church was Black. My neighborhood was Black. I was bused to a white school, and where I was the only Black person in my class for a while. And then my career as a teacher was in a mostly white neighborhood, and I was the first Black teacher in my school. So now I live on the Cape, and I'm in a more of a white community. So I've had the mixtures, I've dealt with people, and it all started with me really feeling insecure about who I am as an African American. I've watched the civil rights movement on television on my black and white screen, and I grew up, my father and Dr. King are about the same age. I'm the same age of Yolanda King. So I was part of the watching the movement, and the shame that I felt really has propelled me to do the work that I do. I feel that I'm an artist because it's a talent. My father was an artist, but I use my art to tell my story and to do my research. And so I started doing that in New York. And then when I came up here, by that time I had a whole collection of African-American history quilts, and I started doing poetry with my husband, who's also a poet, James Walter Miller, Jim, okay. And we started doing poetry together, and this just turned into a place where I could share it.
You talk about shame as you were growing up and you were navigating between, it sounds like two worlds, the neighborhoods you grew up in, and then as you became a professional working in an all-white school. Talk a little bit more about that.
One of the things that I found, well, first of all, the first situation was junior high, where I was bused. And so, believe it or not, I still have some of my friends, mostly the two Jewish, I have a few Jewish friends from my junior high school who are still, I still communicate with them on Facebook and the telephone, and I've gone to parties. So I stayed connected with those people. And as a teacher, my focus was excellence. One of the things that African-Americans learn is that you have to be twice as good to even seem half as good. And in my school, the school that I taught in, had people from all over the world, Asians and every country. And I felt that many of them looked down on African-Americans. So for me, I had to shine. I was going to represent. And so excellence was in my curriculum. It was in everything I did. I was always aware that I was the only Black teacher for a while. I was aware, I felt my presence in my Blackness and realized for the children that were there, I had to represent excellence. And that has been a focus that has carried me to getting those awards, to doing those things. And I think that answers your question.
It does answer the question. It also indicates, too, I mean, that's a high standard, and that's a lot of pressure to put on yourself throughout the years.
Yes, it is. It is, however, I thrive on that pressure, okay? Not everyone, it's not fair. It really isn't. My personality thrives on that, okay? Because I don't compete with others. I compete with myself. And so I'm always striving for those unattainable goals. And but in my mind, I don't see them as unattainable. So I imagine where I'm going, I get a focus, and then I drive straight there. And that's how I operate. So it has worked for me. It's not fair. It's not, you know, it isn't that we have to work so hard, but it has propelled me to where I am today.
Talk a little bit about some of the artwork that you do, because you work in multiple mediums, and,
yes.
and talk about what inspires you to work in those different mediums.
Okay. So it's really my being a teacher. First, I was a special education teacher, and I realized that my students were struggling with the context. And when I taught social studies, I had them draw, and I would draw. And then one day, I put up a bulletin board, but it was all collage. Everybody cut pieces, and we made this whole rural community with pieces. And I said, I really like this. I like cutting. And then I realized I like collage. And so that's where it came. It really, a lot of what I do came from my experience as a teacher. And I, as I said, I was not even an artist when I first started teaching. I was a special ed teacher, and gradually I kept developing my art. I looked at children's books. I loved illustrations. I loved just looking at art. And so when I took a sabbatical, that's when I studied art and came back as the art teacher. So it wasn't the regular path. Many people I know, they studied art in high school. They majored in it in college. They, you know, they went on and they had a background. I did not have that background. And the art that you see today, really, I started this style during my sabbatical. I started playing with paper, and it really started in me trying to do printmaking and finding different papers to print on. And next thing you know, it became collage. And I loved doing the research and then drawing and then creating the images that go with the history.
And
the
extent,
more materials I have, the better, the richer the materials. So now, and it's over time, the materials have gotten into metals and beads and shells and a variety of little stones. So I love it. I love texture.
I was just going to say texture, a lot of texture to help you express what you're researching and what's going on inside your own head and heart.
Yes.
And you've also, as you mentioned, with your husband, been doing some poetry, and we asked you to share one of your poems with us today. You selected My Song for America. Is there anything you'd like to tell us about the poem before we hear it?
Yes. We all sing God Bless America. And as a person of color, and I hear that, and a person of faith, I've often wondered, why are we saying God is the God of the world? And my patriotism is not as strong as my feeling and love for humanity. Because, as I said, I had children from all over the world. I cared for them no matter where they came from. And when I sing God Bless America, I say, well, what about the other people? Is God only blessing America? And when I look at what America has stood for people of color, the Native Americans, and then African Americans, and now other immigrants that come in, I feel pain. And so I wrote this because I was actually writing, I was doing my show for Black Lives Matter in the Soul of America. And I was talking about two Americas. And America, our patriotic songs are about freedom and the joy of freedom. And I'm thinking about our pain. And so I wrote this piece to express the pain that many of us feel, many people of color feel. And now you can cue it.
Let's hear it.
My song to bless America. Where is your soul, America? You boast of liberty. You sing a song of freedom. Such grand hypocrisy. God bless America. Wondering about the songs you sing. Praying to a mighty God for what our God must bring. To a land claimed free. To a people claimed as brave. I know who's free. Not folks like me. Dragged on a ship across the sea. To slave on a land. A land that's free. Oh, my labor's free. And I best be brave. Cause what it takes to be a slave. Don't nobody know what bravery is. Till you fight to survive on the land you live, where the people claimed their liberty and stole your right to live freely. Then sing to God most gratefully about how he gave them liberty. But does God bless a selfish prayer that has no heart, that does not care for all the people that he loves? Whose light he shines on from above? Oh, what a prayer that must be, claiming a land for you and not for me. Yes, I know that slavery's over, but it certainly has a ghost that haunts this very nation, a country God loves most. The colors that we honor, the red, the white, the blue, oh, they have a meaning. I'll tell you what feels true. The red is for the blood that's shed, especially our black sons. The white is always power, power in laws and guns. The blue is how we suffer when family we have lost. Black is disrespected, black bodies simply tossed. God bless America, the red, the white, the blue. I learned the words. Even cried out, Lord, please make these words come true, that God would stand behind her and guide her to have a soul like you. From the mountains to the prairies, to the oceans white with foam, care for my people safely so we can claim this home. God bless America. Help us where we stand. God bless America. Bless this troubled land. Thank you.
What was the reaction that you got when you performed this poem for the
public?
Well,
I'll tell you, I'm feeling pain even now.
Yeah.
When it brings up hurt. It brings up pain. The reaction, well, first of all, okay, it didn't, when I performed it, it was not the poem by itself. It was the whole show. So it was part of the whole Black Lives Matter in the Soul of America. So I didn't get an immediate reaction to that poem. It was a reaction to the whole show. Mm. So I have not done that. It's never been by itself like that. So I can't answer that. I know friends and people I've talked to said, wow, I felt the pain of that. So I have mm-hmm. heard a few things, but when we were doing these shows, there was coronavirus, the pandemic. So people weren't coming out to the shows at Katuit. So this was done at Katuit and we had about 10 people because we could only have a certain amount. So I really haven't, this is the first time it's been, presented in this way. But I feel, let me just say this, I feel that America in so many ways is arrogant. And When I, for example, when I went with my church to Africa, we were told, do not go with your American arrogance, go humbly and learn what the people, what they do, what accept the new, the social graces of the people that are, who are there. Don't come with your own thoughts and your own American attitudes. And so that was an experience that was humbling. And I also see the children who come to the country when I was teaching. And so many people said, okay, you're in America, speak English. And there was an attitude. And actually, when people go to other countries, or, you know, we go to their country, speak English. Okay. We expect certain to be looked up to. And I just don't believe in that. I believe in accepting people where they are and approaching life in a more humble way.
I was going to ask you if doing things like this poetry is therapeutic, but you, right out of listening to it once again, talked about the fact that it is painful. It is. It's very personal.
And yes, it's therapeutic. It is absolutely, because the fact that David Keene, he said to me, Robin, after the George Floyd killing, he said, it's time for white people to listen to Black stories. And I was like, what? Somebody wants to hear what I have to say? Oh, well, they're going to hear what I have to say. They are going to hear what I have to say. I have not been asked before, but now I have an opportunity. So I do the research, I do whatever, and whatever pain that I'm feeling, I put it in my work. And for many of my poems, I'm angry. And I'm not a person who people see anger in me. I'm happy and laughing and whatever, but the anger is there. And this is how I work it out. My excellence is my way of conquering my insecurity of how I feel America sees African-American people. It is my way of working that out.
There's so much more to talk about. And we're talking with artist, educator, and activist Robin Joyce Miller. It's part of our ongoing conversations about race, racism, and white privilege. We need to take a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Catherine Eide and in for Mindy Todd. And today we're talking about art, activism, and the Black Lives Matter movement. My guest this morning is Robin Joyce Miller. Robin, before the break, we were talking about how you channel pain that comes up with the research and the work that you're doing in your art. You channel that into your art that it then goes out into the public. And you mentioned that you've been working with the Kituat Center for the Arts for a while on a series of different presentations about Black Lives Matter. You said that David Keene told you that it was time to tell the stories, and you took him up on that. I want to hear a little bit more about that interaction and how this work
how it came about.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, well, when right after the murder, many organizations sent out messages, you know, on emails, and they said, you know, we support your community. So David sent out to all the members of the Kituat Center for the Arts, and I was a member. So I got, when I saw the letter that he wrote, I sent him back a poem, and my poem was, Where Are the People Who Care, which I dedicated to Dr. King. Where are the people who long to march, who long to walk in the greatest race, the human race? And then it ends with, I know that these people are there, and there's lots of standards. Where are the people, both Black and white, the people who fought the nonviolent fight? And so I sent him that poem, and I wrote at the end, thank you for being one of the people who cares, who's come out and showed that you care. Because it ends with, please, you know, raise your soft voices. We don't hear them loud and clear. Come out and tell the world that you care. And so I sent that poem to him, and he was touched by it, moved. He sent back an email and said, Robin, why don't you and Jim come to Kituat, and we put our mask on and we sat outside. And he also invited the board president, Kathy Lynch Nutting, to join us. So the four of us sat outside of Kituat with our mask. It was in the summer, and I'm a talker, so it was 3 hours. They said, "We don't want to talk. We just want to listen." And I said, "Oh, well, you gonna do that?" No. So there I was talking and talking, and we formed a friendship. And it was beautiful. And so the next thing I said was, "Come to my backyard." And so I had like a little pizza luncheon for them, and we continued the conversation. And he said, "Robin, do you think," because we need more diversity here at Kahtuwit. And he said, "Do you think you could do something, or present something?" And I said, "Well, I've done some slideshow presentations at school. And yeah, you know what? I think I could do a little something. Let me work on it." And so he said, "Well, you do that. How about if you could do from now, do you think you could do 5 shows from now to till from August to December?" And I said, "Yeah." Then as I got going and I got excited, and my mind was, as my dear my white mama Pamela, who's listening, she says, "I have a mind like popcorn, you know, so it's a pop, pop, pop. I get another idea and another idea and another idea." So I was like, "Oh, wow, I was writing up all these different shows." So David said to me, "Robin, as long as you keep producing, writing these shows, we'll keep doing them." So it's been a wonderful relationship with David and Kathy. And so by the end of the year, let's see, we did Black Lives Matter and the Soul of America. We did The Negro Speaks, Langston Hughes. Oh no, the first one was Storing My African Soul. The third one was Black Lives Matter and the Soul of America. The fourth one was Black Children Matter, a legacy, a history of legacy. And then the fifth one was Black Music Matters, the culture of jazz. And then in February, we did Black Churches Matter. And then the last one that we just did, the seventh one, was Coming Black to Cape Cod. So somewhere by December, they were asking me to join the board. And I was thrilled. And that's basically the story. And so I'm still thinking of ways of they can how they can bring more diversity besides me, but more diversity to the Cape, I mean to the Kahtuwit Center for the Arts.
And I should mention that David Keene is the executive director of Kahtuwit Center for the Arts. I think we just kind of threw his name out there
I'm
as if
sorry, yes.
everybody knew him.
Because he's a hot ticket.
That's right. That's right. I want to take just a couple of minutes and look at your most recent presentation that you've done, which is Coming Black to Cape Cod. It looks at Black history, and you perform this show on Juneteenth. How did you conduct the research for this, and who did you talk to
Okay.
learn the things that you found out and you presented?
Okay. Well, first of all, it was because in 2013, I started working at Zion Union Heritage Museum. And when we came to the Cape, we didn't think there was any Black history here at all. We didn't even think there were hardly any Black people. So we get to the museum and we're working there, and tour buses are coming in. And John Reed, the president and director, he's a wealth of knowledge and information. And we started seeing all this information in the museum. And so buses would come. And some days we had 5 buses, but John would tell a different story to each of the groups. And I said, "Oh my gosh, listen to this information." So I started writing information and documenting and saying, "This is fascinating," but I was frustrated. The teacher in me said, "People aren't getting all this information. They're only here for an hour and a half, and we're also doing creative presentations, so they're not getting all this history. There's not enough time." So I started gathering it, looking at it, talking to John, and then I put together a little booklet, and I said, "John, it took a while for them to get it," and he said, "All right, let me add to it." And so John added to the booklet, and I don't know, one day I came up with the concept, because I was going to do a book. I said, "Coming Black," instead of "Coming Back to Cape Cod," "Coming Black to Cape Cod." So I told people, "I'm going to do a book coming," and they all were like, "Oh, that sounds great." So when this opportunity at Kahtuwit came, I said, "Oh, that'll be a show that I can do." But meanwhile, I did research in, there were a lot of people there. I mean, I didn't have to go very far. The information was there, and John gave me a lot of information. Nancy Shoemaker gave me information. There were just lots of people. I had Pamela and David Purdy, and they're part of the museum. They're part of the history. I have Carl Lopes, part of the history. Joe Diggs was there. You know, Deleuze's, their story was phenomenal. Then I learned about the reverse Freedom Riders. So all that information was bottled up in that museum, but it wasn't coming out and it wasn't known. And so, yes, I'm a wash ashore, but I came from New York and said, whoa, look what I discovered. This is like a grand discovery. And to find information that you feel that people don't know, that's exciting. And it's like, you feel like a pioneer. Someone said, Robin, you're blazing a trail. And to be able to tell a story that really hasn't been told. The Martha's Vineyard story has been told, you know, and we used to go to Martha's Vineyard. So I said, this is a story that hasn't been told. People don't realize how wonderful the people are here and how powerful and what they've been doing. There's a whole history. And so I drummed it up and researched it, and there's more. And people told me at my show, it's not complete. Well, of course it's not. And I'm looking to get stories from people now, you know, to hear, to tell the stories. And I don't know, I never know immediately what I'm going to do with it. Is it going to be a show? Is it going to be a book? Is it going to be what? I don't always know. That evolves in time.
And that makes sense. As you let it kind of sit with you, and as you learn more information, you can kind of find the best outlet for transmitting that information and getting it out there to people. Yeah. You mentioned that people who attended the presentation, because you did this live on Juneteenth, coming back to Cape Cod. Some people said it's incomplete, which of course any history is incomplete. Right. And that's an exciting thing, as you said, because there's so much more to discover. What other kinds of reaction did you get? Did you get any?
Well, mostly it was a really positive reaction. People applauded. They were excited. Well, see, first of all, the other thing that was exciting for the people there, they were the history makers. I invited the people in the show. So there's nothing greater than seeing yourself. Okay. So, I mean, there were other people as well, plenty of people, but many of the people were in the show, or their families were in the show. So for them, it was all about honoring them. It was the fact that I wanted to show them that I stand in awe of what you've done. And I stand in awe of the community. And so they were being honored. So the reaction was mostly positive, you know. So some of the people who might have I don't think they were in it, you know. So, but people who were in it were excited to be included, and I just felt joy in being able to do that.
So you mentioned, of course, it's such a fun presentation. And as you said, there's so much to learn. And of course, you can only, you know, you had to cover so many topics throughout, you know, from the 1600s to today that you can only kind of touch on things. You mentioned the Reverse Freedom Riders. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? That certainly is a story that I'm not sure a lot of Cape Codders know.
Right. Well, this is during the civil rights movement when President Kennedy was in office, and white people in the South, they sent blacks on a bus. They paid for them, giving them promissory notes saying that President Kennedy has jobs for you. But that's just in Hyannis. Although these freedom rides went to other cities as well, where whites were sending blacks to Northerners saying, okay, you like black people so much, we'll send them to you and you can give them jobs. But the people thought they were tricked. They thought there were jobs waiting for them. There were places waiting for them, that they were going to be welcomed with open arms. So people like Dolores Deluze and her husband and the NAACP up here on the Cape, when they came into Hyannis, they heard about it and were prepared, and they took them to Otis Air Force, you know, to house them, and they helped them look for jobs. Some of the families went back home. It was humiliating. Some of them families today don't even want to say that they were part of that hoax. So it was an ugly hoax, and it was called the Reverse Freedom Riders because they were sent on buses up north thinking that they were something wonderful was going to happen to them for them. And it was not the case. It was white people humiliating Blacks and also trying to humiliate here in Hyannis. They wanted to humiliate President Kennedy because he knew nothing about it. But they thought that President Kennedy was going to be waiting in Hyannis for them and, you know, welcoming them.
It's a heartbreaking
story that a lot of people don't know.
It is. And it's a heartbreaking story and an important story to understand, because as you said yourself, and I think a lot of other people feel this way, you come to the Cape and it is mostly white, and you think, well, there's no diversity here. And in fact, there is this rich history of folks here who stood up and tried to help. This is an embarrassing moment in history for Americans,
yes.
But
yes.
It does tie the Cape to these national stories about
yes.
Black history that are so very important. And,
yes.
You know, it brings it right home in a real way.
Yes. And someone like Eugenia Forts, because the story also, it's not just African-Americans, but Cape Verdeans. And you had Cape Verdeans like Eugenia Forts, who claimed to be the first Black Cape Verdean, because Cape Verdeans with their Creole background were not, and coming not through slavery, but coming on ships into the whaling, through the whaling industry, coming into New England, had a different attitude than about the African-Americans, and they didn't want to relate and connect to them because they could see how Black people were being treated in this country. So they didn't really want to call themselves Black. Eugenia's attitude was, when they see you, they're going to say you're Black. So you might as well join the group. You might as well become part of it, because Cape Verdeans are off the coast of Africa, but they are a Creole mix of Portuguese and other European countries. But many of them wanted to claim whiteness. And I can understand that, because what Black people want to claim whiteness. They were, you know, it's like, that's what was happening. If they were light enough, they would try to pass. They were, you know, if you're in a group of people who are dehumanized, demoralized, and just treated so badly, who wants to be a part of that group? If you have a way to escape, you take the escape. And so there have been those who fought the battle, and I'm proud of those people. Langston Hughes is one of the people who, though very light and fair, he fought for Blackness and was very proud of his African heritage. So I have realized how important, how rich African heritage is. And that's another story that I'll be talking about at some point, the great kingdoms of Africa. Mm. So there's so much that I, in my anger, saying, what? You said we were no one? Oh no, I'll show you who we are. And that is the premise. That's my basis that I do the work. That's what motivates me.
And from a historical perspective, just looking at this one presentation that you've done, Coming Black to Cape Cod, you've highlighted so many leaders, historic leaders, current leaders here on the Cape, people of color, people who identify as Black, people who are Cape Verdean, who have been and have done some really amazing things, like the Deluzes,
yes.
with the Reverse Freedom Rides and other things, you know, calling attention to inequities by sitting at a lunch counter on Main Street. I mean, there's also in Hyannis, just there's a lot of stories.
Yes.
There's so much
to
dig into.
Here. So many of the ministers in that show that I talk about, and even today, Will Mebbin and the in Falmouth, he's doing a show with Angele Scott, and they're doing, The Conversation. And that started in last year because of George Floyd. So people are, there's activism still going on, and there's a young group, the Cape Cod Voices, Miranda and Chandler Alves. So there are people doing things, and it's exciting.
It's really exciting. I think it's interesting too that, and I'm glad that you brought up Eugenia Fortes, because as a Cape Verdean, someone who identified as Cape Verdean but also Black, because I think a really interesting piece of your presentation, Coming Black to Cape Cod, is I think as humans, as we try to understand something, we often put blanket terms on things. And your research really quickly unearthed the fact that one blanket term does not give people an accurate picture of the true diversity of people who are not white living on Cape Cod.
Yes. I found it interesting. I told this story and people chuckle. Because I go back and forth to New York to my doctors, and one of my doctors, I told him, he goes, "Oh, you're in the Cape?" And he says, "Well, what are you doing?" And I said, "I'm doing a Black Lives Matter series." He said, "What?" He's Asian. And he said, "I've been to the Cape. It's pretty J. Crew." So I laughed. I laughed, especially when I was at the mall the other day and I saw J. Crew, you know, I thought of what he said. But, you know, many people don't know, even the Black people who come on the tour buses, they're always surprised because they've been touring around and they haven't seen Black people and they haven't seen anything Black. And they're like, "Wow, this museum is here? What? We didn't know you were here." And there's an excitement to that.
We're talking with artist, educator, and activist Robin Joyce Miller. It's part of our ongoing conversations about race, racism, white privilege, and the Black Lives Matter movement. We have to take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Iden, and today we're talking about art, activism, and Black Lives Matter, especially on Cape Cod. And my guest this morning is Robin Joyce Miller. Robin, we've been talking about history and the importance of history, especially unearthing Black history here on Cape Cod. And we've talked a little bit about the Zion Heritage Museum in Hyannis, which is a museum dedicated to Black, Brazilian, Cape Verdean, and Wampanoag people who live and work in the region. You know, you talk about people who are just awestruck and so surprised at the wealth of information and exhibits at the museum, which is right here for everybody to see and to take part in. And that's true of other museums and cultural centers dedicated to Black history in the U.S., right? Like, what more can be done to elevate museums like the Zion Heritage and others across the U.S.?
Well, we need the kind of funding that is going to keep the museum going. John Reed is wonderful, but he is not really being paid. We don't have a paid kind of position. And so many African-American museums across the country struggle with that. Not enough money is coming into the programs, you know, into feeding the museums. So that's one thing that needs to really to strengthen the museum. I don't know the future. I'm not a museum administrator. I don't have a museum background. I've gone to museums. I've facilitated at museums, but there's really a lot to know about running a museum, and we could use help. And so people who have money or funding or whatever, we need it to come into the museum.
It's as simple as that. It's as difficult as that, but also as simple as that. It's it's putting the money where the art
And I'm sure
is.
There are other answers, but I'm not the one. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. There are other people who could answer that question better than I could. So I just speak from my level of knowledge.
I want to talk a little bit about your faith, Robin. You're a member of the West Parish Church in Barnstable. How does your faith intersect with your activism around diversity, equity, and inclusion?
That's very interesting, because just now while we're sitting here waiting, I got an email back from my pastor. On July 1st, I am going to be doing the sermon at West Parish of Barnstable. And what's August amazing, 1st. They are doing something extremely controversial. And that is, they are going to put up my Ethiopian Last Supper piece, okay, work of art. So the white Jesus is actually coming down and Black Jesus is going up. And for a church that is historical, I'm going to be talking a little bit about it. I don't want to give away what I'll be saying, but that church has worked with us and we have worked with them. Going there was God meant for us to go to that church. There's no question about it. They have helped us grow. We have helped them grow. It has been a mutual relationship built on faith, responsibility, and a lot of love. And so we've been embraced by that church. And what more can I say? I love West Parish of Barnstable. I love Reed, who's the pastor, and Christy, who's his wife and the associate pastor. They are my friends. I forgot to tell them about the program today. Is this coming on tonight at 7 or?
It will be rebroadcast, yes. And it'll
okay,
be
okay, because I got to tell, there's so much going on, and I was working on my all kinds of things, but I forgot to let them know that they could be listening to this. So,
well, they'll be able to
find
it. I am
talking about them, and I'm sending them lots of love.
Well, and it sounds like you do have a wonderful relationship with this church. It feeds you, you're feeding into the community, you're all growing and changing. Has that required at times any uncomfortable conversations? We've been talking about that so much over the last year or more in the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement and talking about racism and white privilege.
I would say that certainly not with Reed and Christy. Our conversations have never been difficult. Well, but I've had them over. It was funny. We had them over with another couple from the church, and they came over to talk race. And so my husband, Jim, this is very funny. He said, while we were cleaning up the house before they came, he said, this is the Black only bathrooms. So when they came, one of them went to go to the restroom. And I said, excuse me, where are you going? No, no, no. That's the Black only bathroom. Your bathroom's outside. And Jim was horrified. And I said, they came to talk race, right? So let's talk it. So we always have wonderful conversations, but they've had some difficult conversations at church about white privilege. We were invited to when the United Church of Christ president, John Dorhauer, came to their house for a dinner. They invited us to the dinner party to discuss white privilege. And then Reed and Christy in the church did 3 programs on white privilege. Jim and I came to the last one, and that is why I did the poem, Never Had the Privilege, because I knew they were going to ask me to speak about it. And so we came to the 3rd meeting, and some people, it's not always easy. And he, as Reed says, it's a purple church. It's blue and red. And so you have people during when Trump was elected, there were people in the church who didn't want to sit next to other people. He had to call a meeting in the church to discuss, you know, people were angry. You voted, who did you vote for? When they realized who different people voted for, they were upset. So there were Republicans who did not vote for Trump, but there were people who did vote for Trump. And, you know, there's been, in fact, one couple who I know, they're not even there now in the church. So I'm just saying there are problems. And they come up, but that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to come together, discuss the issues, even though they're very hard and often painful.
Does your work with diversity, equity, inclusion apply to the other organizations of which you are a part here on the Cape? How are you working with those groups?
Okay, I'm not really, okay, I'm only on the board of Kituit, okay. I'm not on any other boards. I am on the committee, Falmouth Art Diversity Committee. So that just means that I'm, you know, part of Zion. I'm not on the board there. I am a resident artist and volunteer there. So I just bring who I am with me wherever I go. And when I'm with the Falmouth on Zoom talking about diversity, we just, you know, I'm just throwing in what little thoughts I have. And that's pretty much it. I, you know, what you see is what you get. So wherever I am, I'm talking the same line, I'm the same person. And I try to find ways to connect. I did go to the Cape Verdean Museum opening, and I said to them, if they're doing something interesting and they want to share it, please let me know so I can bring that to David Keynes. Maybe we can do something. Oh, also, I was interviewed by Mashpee TV, and 2 of the women who were the crew were Wampanoag. So we also talked about bringing some Wampanoag information and programs to Kituit. So, you know, it's really just about when you mix with people, having the conversations and saying and looking for an opening and an opportunity.
And it sounds like you are so very open about things that can be, as I said, so uncomfortable and exhausting for many people. Do you ever find yourself giving advice to people who are a little timid about becoming more open and talking about sensitive subjects and moving past that uncomfort?
Yes. I start off, in fact, Reed said to me once when we were at church, he said, you handled that very well because people were getting angry and they were saying things. First of all, I let people know when we're having discussions, there are no wrong questions. You know, it has to be in an environment where people can feel free to speak their mind. And if I find the need to say something like, well, you're not really familiar with this, let me enlighten you about this, or yes, I understand what you're saying. We have to have an open ear to what's happening. But yeah, there's the conversations of poor whites. I was having a conversation with a friend the other day about poor whites and listening to their story. Sometimes I find it difficult because I feel that poor whites were not held back because of their race. There's certain things have happened to them or whatever, but it wasn't because they're white. But Black people have been held back and have not been able to do things just because. So it's a difficult situation coming, the poor whites and poor Blacks in the South, you know, they were butting heads, and people are always butting heads, and I don't have the answers to everything. So I keep reading and looking and trying to find ways to discuss these things in a better way. You know, letting people who are more informed than me. I'm not the end all and be all ever. I will never claim that. I just come out with what I feel and what I've learned, but I don't have all the answers. There are other people who are far more skilled and knowledgeable than I am. And I bow to those people for their information and what they can contribute.
As you kind of look back on the last year or so since the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and you look ahead, how do you feel? Are you optimistic or a little pessimistic maybe?
Someone did ask me that, and do you feel that we're turning a corner? And my attitude to that is, you know how many times we thought we were turning a corner? When slavery ended, we thought we were turning a corner. When Reconstruction, we thought we were turning a corner. When Martin Luther King, when the Civil Rights Act came out, we thought we were in 64, I believe. We thought we were turning a corner. But Dr. King was killed. And then when we got his holiday, we thought we were turning a corner. We thought clearly when Barack Obama was voted for, you know, became president for two terms, that we were turning a corner. We turned an ugly corner. Okay, so, you know, then I was just recently asked, do you feel that after the verdict of Chauvin, do you feel we're turning a corner? I don't look at turning corners and whatever. One, I don't have a crystal ball. I am not God. And do I feel optimistic or pessimistic? I don't really feel either way. I just feel that each one of us has to do our part, because all of us have a purpose here and on earth to do something good. And that's all I can focus on. I can't focus on where the world is going. I'm not a political person. I'm a person who just deals with the people around me. If each of us deal with the people who are around us in positive ways, there are some people who go out and fight the battles. I'm not that person. I will speak my piece creatively and do my part, but I'm not a picket line and on there and yelling and screaming. And that's for someone else. And that's, okay. But we all contribute to this, to this cause.
Robin, thank you so much for talking with us this hour and sharing your passion, sharing some of your poetry, and there's so much more you have to offer. Thank you again. We are out of time.
Thank you.
That's Robin Joyce Miller. And I want to thank you for listening to this episode of The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd.
This is CAI. We have a clarification. Robin Joyce Miller will be giving the sermon at West Parish of Barnstable on Sunday, August 1st. There's more information at our website, capeandislands.org.